This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the final episode of season two of the AI Health Podcast.
It's been an amazing season and so much fun to speak with so many leaders in the field. And of course, none of this would have been possible without our listeners. So thank you so much to everyone who's tuning in right now, whether it's your first time with us or whether you've been with us from the very beginning.
Yeah, we can't thank all of you enough. And we hope you have found all these conversations as interesting as Adrielle and I have.
So Pranav, who do we have for the final episode of this season?
So for the final episode of the season, we have Professor George Church. George Church is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and professor of health sciences and technology at Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His pioneering work has contributed to the development of key DNA sequencing and genome engineering technologies. He has co-authored over 550 publications, more than 150 patents. He's also initiated the Personal Genome Project and started over 20 companies.
He's an absolute legend, and I'm really excited to learn more about some of these startups in our conversation. So what will we talk about with him?
We'll talk about quite a bit, including the de-extinction of the woolly mammoth, how machine learning has led to breakthroughs in protein design, and why Professor Church thinks that dating apps should include screening by genetics.
So since it's our last episode of the season, I thought that we could very quickly run through all the guests that we've had on the show for season two. Do you want to kick us off, Pranav?
Yeah. So we started our season with Vivian Lee from Verily and talked about making the U.S. healthcare system more efficient and effective through AI. We spoke with Zach Kohani of Harvard Medical School about medical data sharing and gaining actionable insights. We spoke with Noemi Al-Haddad from Columbia University on using crowdsourced data to study menstrual health.
We chatted with Tom Simonite at Wired about the challenges of keeping the general public informed about AI and health. We spoke with Varun Ganapati from Akasa about how AI can help make healthcare billing less painful for all of us. We spoke with Sherry Rose at Stanford University about detangling causation from correlation and measuring the effectiveness of different interventions.
Also at Stanford University, we spoke with Susan Athey on the role of businesses, legislators, and universities in ensuring AI is used ethically. We spoke with Joshua Gordon at the National Institute of Medical Health on how AI can be used to provide more accurate psychiatric diagnoses and better target treatments for mental illnesses. We spoke with Nan Li at Obvious Ventures on how physical tools and AI are industrializing drug discovery and allowing for discovery at an unprecedented pace.
We also had Julie Yu from Andreessen Horowitz as a guest, and we spoke about opportunities in digital health and her journey from operator to investor. We spoke with Krishna Yeshwant at GV about different segments of the healthcare market and then the role that investors play in improving medicine. We spoke with Trishan Panch from WellFrame about demystifying complex care regimens and providing personalized support to patients and understanding the social issues that affect healthcare.
Then we spoke with Suchi Saria at Bayesian Health on using insights from EHR data to detect diseases and improve patient outcomes. We spoke with Louis Volok at Immuni on applying AI to immunology, genomics, and drug discovery. And then we spoke with Karandeep Singh at the University of Michigan about how we deploy and rigorously evaluate machine learning models in real clinical practice.
We had a lot of amazing conversations, and our conversation with Professor Church is a great capstone to our season two.
It certainly will be. Let's dive right into it. Well, Dr. Church, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure. Yeah.
You have been over many years working at the forefront of countless fields, including genomics, gene editing, organoids, synthetic biology, and de-extinction. And I'd love to, in our conversation today, go over some of these problems and how you've tackled them and how you think about them in terms of the future going forward. I'd love to start by asking you about the mission of the de-extinction of the woolly mammoth. Would love to know where that came from.
That actually came from, we developed technology for automated DNA sequencing, which suddenly made it possible to sequence ancient DNA. And a number of groups started sequencing older and older DNA, starting with like mummies, 1,000-year-old. And now the record is 1,000,000 years old. So that's the first step, is being able to read that. And then the second is being able to edit DNA. So we developed a number of methods, including CRISPR, but other editing methods. And we've applied those to pigs and shown that we can make a highly edited pig for organ transplant. That was the reason to feel that it should work on other large mammals, larger than human. And so that was part two. Part three is we have published ways to differentiate stem cells into a whole variety of other cells, including eggs and endometrium, endothelium, all these things that are needed for developing embryos. And so we're trying to grow embryos outside the body. And then I guess another component is collaboration with Pleistocene Park and hopefully many other parks in Russia, Canada, and the United States, Arctic, where they're testing whether restoration of Arctic herbivores would be beneficial for the carbon sequestration and keeping the 1,400 gigatons of carbon frozen in the soil.
Wow.
Those are some of the key components. And we've made most of our progress we've made because we had funding for human technology for human health. And that's almost immediately applicable to veterinary health as well.
I'd love to learn about how this experiment works. So what is the sample that you're starting with? As I understand it, you're starting with elephants. And then what happens?
Well, so part of this is aimed at the Arctic and for the world atmosphere, but part of it is aimed at endangered species, developed technologies that would be used for endangered species in general, and elephants in particular. All the current elephant species are endangered, but we're starting with cells from them. So we don't bother the elephants. We just work with their cells, just like with the pigs. We worked with pig cells and we engineered them with CRISPR and other tools until they were highly engineered. And then we would test them by cloning them and making embryos or piglets, or in this case, it would be elephant calves, and then seeing whether our plans had worked out. They typically do work out with a little bit of debugging at the cellular level.
And so is the idea that you have a starting point, which is, let's say, an elephant cell, and then let's say you have a read of the woolly mammoth, and then you're trying to bridge the gap between the two. Is that a fair way to understand it?
Yeah, we read from the ancient DNA, which is all broken up, into a computer, and then the computer reassemble it, and then another computer will direct the printing of new fresh DNA that could be longer than the original DNA, or the ancient DNA, the degraded DNA, and now the new big DNA can be inserted into the elephant genome, where it will recombine. Or we can just use the computer version of the genome to guide us to make little point mutations, where we'll just change one A to a G. So those are the two main methods, is like inserting big piece of DNA or just changing one base pair. And there's maybe 3 million or so differences between you and me, and a similar number between Asian elephants and mammoths. And we don't really want all of those, just like we don't need to make every difference between you and me to evaluate a genetic disease. In me, of course, not in you. So the same thing's true here, is we just want to change a few of the positions that are relevant to having it thrive in the Arctic at minus 40 degrees in the winter. And there are even a few things that are not present in the mammoths or the modern elephants that we'd like to introduce, things like resistance to killer extinction level herpes viruses and maybe tusk length for avoiding poachers.
Huh. I'm kind of curious about whether or not there's a sort of strategy here. So sort of the de-extinction of the woolly mammoth is a very cool thing sort of in and of itself. And then of course, helping prevent the extinction of current species that, you know, we know and love is also important in and of itself. But was there some sort of strategy also where, you know, if we can do this for this type of mammal, then maybe we can extend this to humans? Or was it really mostly just about, could we do this cool thing?
Well, yeah, it was motivated by the endangered species, by the climate change. And there is an interaction between human health and veterinary health. For example, we have some veterinary products that we're developing for dogs for aging reversal of dog aging, and that will turn into human clinical trials and vice versa. A lot of things we learned about making human gametes, eggs, is going to benefit the elephant project because we don't want to bother the endangered mothers for eggs. That's actually a very invasive procedure, especially for animals. And then it may return again if the artificial womb works out, then that might be beneficial in certain cases in humans. But we wouldn't want to develop that in humans because there's a lot of debugging that would not be ideal to do in humans. You'd want to do in animals first.
Got it. So there's sort of this trust where when you have an interesting problem like this that's maybe motivated by climate change or the de-extinction of the animals that we care about, that we'll have enough learnings that will apply to so many other areas that it's worth our time and investment.
Yeah.
Has it been difficult to find funding for this, though? I imagine there's more funding available for human trials and experiments than for animals like elephants.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. I can't actually say it was difficult. I suspect it would have been difficult, but I was so intimidated by the difficulty that I didn't even try. So it's hard to say. I felt it would not appeal to government agencies, it would not appeal to philanthropists, and would not appeal to investors. So I just basically funded it on a shoestring as well as I could with money that I got from royalties from my other inventions that were unencumbered by any satisfying anybody in particular. And then I got about $100,000 each from Peter Thiel and from Revive and Restore, which is a molecularly inspired conservation movement. Mm. And that was very helpful, although the spread out over a decade, that's barely enough to keep the project going.
Yeah.
Then we met Ben Lamb and he got very infatuated with it. And he's raised over $75 million so far. So that's a big uptick from about $10,000 a year. So now I have to say, in retrospect, it wasn't that hard to raise that amount of money. There are a lot of enthusiastic events. So maybe there's a lesson in there for all of us that if you don't try, you're definitely going to fail.
Yeah. You don't get what you don't ask for, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I'd love to switch gears a little bit and talk about one of the aspects you mentioned here, which was aging reversal. Now, this is a very specific term. Could you start by sharing with our listeners what you mean by aging reversal?
Well, really, we're talking about reversal of age-related diseases. But almost every disease is age-related. Almost every form of morbidity, mortality, even things you don't normally think of as diseases, like falling down and not getting up. You know, COVID-19 has a very steep age effect and a very steep cognitive effect on top of the respiratory effects. And the list goes on, almost every disease. And so if you go to the FDA with a reversal of a disease, chances are it'll be age-related disease, and they'll approve it if it works, if it's safe and effective. And then it's easy to apply that if that therapy was aimed at the core commonality that they all have in common, which is aging. You don't have to call aging a disease. You just know that it will fix all these things at once. You get approval for one, and then it's easy to get extension of the approval for other diseases.
Sounds great. And so how did Rejuvenate Bio, which you've co-founded, come as a result of your work on aging reversal?
Noah Davidson, which was one of the co-founders of Rejuvenate Bio, was a postdoctoral fellow in my lab. And he, not quite single-handedly, but with some helpers, tested about 45 gene therapies that were basically from the literature. I mean, our lab works on it, but we basically got these 45. And then he winnowed that down to 3 very promising genes, which he then tried in every possible combination of 1, 2, and 3. At once, and tried it with initially 4 different diseases, now about 7 different or accelerated aging disease models. And we published that and 3 other studies in collaboration with other groups. The combination therapy, I think, is appropriate, just as it is used in cancer and HIV and antibacterials. You often use multiple at once to make sure it doesn't slip around. And the same thing's true for aging. There's about 9 different pathways that we understand pretty well, and we need to get all of them at once, probably, because if there's one way to age or there's one way to die, you're going to take that. Your body's going to eventually hit that way. So you have to tackle them all at once. So anyway, there's 2 ways of delivering multiple drugs, if you will, different gene therapies. Either the gene therapies that kind of act on a cell, whichever cell they get delivered to, and no others. And then there's the other one where it acts on a cell, and then that cell produces proteins that are released into the bloodstream and into the tissues, and it has a kind of a broader effect. And we like that second one a little bit more, but we're pursuing both at Rejuvenate Bio. The second one, where it spreads out from the place where you injected it, means you don't have to have quite as high efficiency to hit a lot of different cells. In fact, maybe all the cells in your body. It's very similar to the vaccines that many of us recently took. Those are almost all, there's 5 of them, almost all of them are either a viral capsid delivery of a double-stranded DNA or a lipid nanoparticle delivery of a single-stranded messenger RNA, but they're both basically using the tools of gene therapy that spread via the immune system through the whole body.
There's a pathway you've thought about here, going from mice to dogs to humans. Could you maybe give us a sense of what are the challenges associated with making every jump? And where are we in terms of evidence right now along the spectrum?
Right. So one challenge that's a little more unique to gene therapy is that you really want to customize it for this species. And the FDA would prefer that you use exactly the same drug, maybe adjust the dose per kilogram for different species, but you want to have, so if you're going to use rapamycin, which is somewhat aging related drug, or metformin, you use literally the same chemical in mice and dogs and humans. But for these, we used a mouse specific proteins, genes, and dog and human. That's one small thing. It's not that big a deal. The FDA is okay with it. They'd prefer to have it tested in animals than not, and that you want it to be optimally tested. The other thing is, yeah, dose does change from organism. It doesn't just scale per kilogram. There's a difference in treatment of each. So the typical lore is that if you have even a primate clinical trial, the human trial is going to go better because primates just don't get as good care. You know, if you need a transfusion or a year of dialysis, you're not going to do that typically in a primate trial. Similarly, dogs get much better treatment than mice do, or more human-like. They might eat the same food as their pet owners. They might sleep in the same environment. They relate to each other, to humans, the way humans relate to each other, you know, eye contact and so forth. So anyway, there's advantages and disadvantages to each of these systems, but the gold standard is human clinical trials in the end.
I feel like there's a lot of backlash against aging, or maybe controversy around it. Like if I speak to some friends of mine, they kind of snub their noses a little bit at it, or they're like, oh, well, we're meant to age. You know what? This is just what rich Silicon Valley people care about. And I love that you emphasize that this is about being able to tackle diseases that come as we age. And I like your emphasis on that. But what do you think about this sort of knee-jerk reaction against a lot of the aging research that's come out? Where do you think this comes from? Why does society sort of worry about us playing God in this way when we play God, when we try to fight cancer, you know?
I think there's a tendency to prefer the natural, and natural is basically defined as the technology that our grandparents used. So it's not really natural like our ancestors 20,000 years ago used, or even humans today that are isolated from all industrial technology. It's really just whatever nostalgic view we had about our recent ancestors. So that's part of it, is a nostalgia. The other part is doubt that it works. It's easy to kind of pile up on something you think isn't going to work. You can say, you know, I told you so, or something like that. Even if you didn't necessarily say it wasn't going to work, you just said something negative and it kind of covers all your bases. A third reason is, I mean, they might be worried about overpopulation or jobs for young people or something like that. But I think the way you phrase their comments, it's more a matter of why should we mess with it? And that has to do with, they might imagine that you're going to live from age 80 to age 180 in a state of severe debilitation. I mean, you lived 180, but who would want to? If you get down and you ask them, okay, if you were felt like you're 25 now, and you felt like you're 25 when you're 125, and you felt like you're 25 when you're 180, are you really going to want to pull your own plug?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see how you might ask for euthanasia if you've felt miserable for years, but not if you're like doing backflips and, you know, winning races with your grandchildren.
Yeah.
It's just, I think if they fully visualize what the possibilities are, they might be less skeptical, but it's good to be skeptical. I mean, I'm a big fan of dystopic science fiction because it, in a way, it's like a vaccine. It kind of protects us from that particular set of scenarios. We've lived through that virtually. And so we're probably not going to make exactly the mistakes they made in Jurassic Park or Gattaca. We'll make a different set of mistakes.
But I think you're right. Like, I think people focus too much on the, oh, we're trying to live forever, and less on the, no, we're just trying to live as long as we live, but feel better in those years that we're living as long as we live.
It's not just feeling better. It's contributing to society better. You know, if I feel like I'm 25 and all the repair processes in my body are working that way, then why retire? I mean, you know, hopefully I have the limberness and the freedom of mind that I'm being creative like a 25-year-old too. And so I should be part of the workforce. And that could save us a lot of money, at least, you know, for a few decades until we figure out what we're going to do next.
Well, let's talk very quickly about the economic impacts. Is that something that you have to consider when you're doing this kind of work? You mentioned overpopulation or fewer jobs for young people. Is that something that has to be top of mind for you? Or are you sort of like, we'll cross that bridge when we get there?
You know, I think some scientists don't consider that top of mind, that sort of ethics beyond what they're required to do. My lab likes to do that. I mean, it's, in fact, we like to have those articles precede the recipe for how to do it, because, you know, you want to have a broad discussion involving, you know, a diverse group of people, and you need to visualize it very carefully in advance. In terms of the economics, I think that there might be a worth considering that we're no longer in the era of population explosion. We're entering the era of population implosion because, you know, as 80%+ of people start entering the cities, living in cities, they change their expectations from 7 to 1.2 kids on average. And so 1.2 is implosion. It is shrinking population. And we're seeing that, you know, in every country that has a big city. And even before they become wealthy, just entering the city, they change their family expectations. A second possible drain is the same drain that we saw from Europe when the Americas opened up, is a lot of people left Europe. Not everybody, but certain kinds of people felt it was more attractive there. And the same thing will probably happen for various colonies in space and on planets and on moons, where a certain subset of us will want to go there. And if it works out, then an even bigger subset will want to go there. And that's another drain. So there's two drains. And also our planet could hold a lot more and still have a lot more room for national parks than we have right now if we just used farmland more reasonably. You know, right now we're using tens of acres per person. And there are plans where you could have the amount of solar panels for a family house could support a family for food. So it doesn't have to be tens of acres per person. And a lot of that has to do with our obsession with meat, which requires a lot more acreage, water, zoonotic disease exposure, et cetera. So it'd be a win-win to shrink down to a more manageable size. And then it could be more of us and still more wildlife.
Yeah.
A scary statistic, 96% of mammals worldwide, not just in rich countries, worldwide, 96% of mammals are now humans and their domesticated mammals.
Wow, that is a crazy statistic.
96%. It's scary, yeah. And that could change in a heartbeat. It could drop down to 30-some percent, which is just the number of humans. And then the rest could be natural species.
Huh.
Oh, that's by biomass, not by number. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Humans are big mammals. So are most of the ones we eat.
True. And I guess it's worth telling our audience, you are vegan, right?
I am. Yeah, full disclosure, I have a conflict of interest. I'm vegan. And I highly recommend it. I've been vegan for a very long time. And you can see it stunted my growth, but it was worth it. Yeah. I'm only 6'4".
Love to switch gears and talk about sequencing the genome. You've been at the forefront of this for a long time, and now we have technologies that allow us for a few hundred dollars to sequence the genome. Do you think there is more work to do? Are there better technologies that are needed to sequence the DNA and the other parts of the genome?
I actually think that the technology will keep improving, sometimes by factors of 10 per year, so it's faster than Moore's Law. I don't think it needs to at this point. I think what we need now is better software. So it's kind of like transparent, so you know what's going on as much as you want to, but it's not in your face. So it's kind of like Google Maps, right? It'll tell you to turn left without giving you all the gory detail about the atomic clocks that support the GPS satellites, that support the GIS information from the maps and all that. So you want something that's transparent, but yet simple interface, if you want it to be simple. So that's missing. The cost is already below zero in a certain sense. If everybody got sequenced, or even if a lot of people got sequenced, right now genomes are about $100 cost and $300 price. But for every $300 that you pay, you'll get $10,000 back on average. Some people won't get anything back, but a lot of people will get millions of dollars back because that's how much it costs to pay for an orphan disease typically these days over a lifetime. So the entire system, whoever's paying for those medical costs, whether it's a insurance agency, a government, or employer, whatever, they're going to make millions on the 2 to 6% of the population that's very severely damaged by their genetics. But that could be avoided by genetic counseling, preconception.
Wow. Related to this idea, I wanted to chat about Nebula Genomics. Could you share what the idea of this company and the promise here is?
Right. So I've been involved in almost all the companies that have provided whole genome sequencing to people, not just a few SNPs or a few genes, but everything, starting in 2007 with Gnome, which was $350,000 per genome. I mean, the first genome was not clinical grade, so that we don't even talk about that, but that was $3 billion. But clinical grade genome, $350,000, and then Veritas offered it for the first $1,000 genome, and Nebula the first $300 genome. But Nebula brings even more to it than that. They have really great interpretation software that includes so-called risk scores, PRSs, which gather together a number of related genes and says, if you look at all of the variation in those genes, then you have a better idea about diabetes than if you look at each of them individually. Another thing that Nebula does is new ways of maintaining security. So to some extent, all this amazing security is ridiculous if you go out of your house, because if you go to your house, you're leaving DNA all over the place and people could easily sequence it. But let's say that people aren't going to get your DNA any other way, then you want to make sure that it's secure. For example, some hospitals that will remain nameless, whenever a celebrity or a celebrity athlete comes in, suddenly the number of people who need to know goes up by orders of magnitude, you know, hospital staff. And so one way you can do this is with homomorphic encryption queries, where you're storing all the transactions on a public blockchain, but then you can actually keep the data encrypted and you can ask a question about it without decrypting it. So no one has to have a completely decrypted form of your genome, including you. If the government comes in and says, you know, you have your genome, you say, yes, I have my genome, but they can't read it. And that's true. You can't read it, but you could ask, if they wanted to ask, do you have a pre-diabetic predisposition, then they could probably find that out.
So the idea here is to combine some computation, in this case, homomorphic encryption, to enable security with collecting data
right
at scale.
Correct.
Related to this idea is this idea of personal genome sequencing. Could you talk about the transition, what the word personal adds and what that field has looked like?
So when we started the idea of personal genomes back in 2005, I wrote an editorial in Nature MSB. Part of it was just everybody was talking about genomes as if there was one genome, like there was the human genome. Or worse yet, there was one genome per person. Even if you generalize it a little bit, the fact is each of us has two genomes, one from a mother, one from a father, which is not exactly the same. It's half of each of them, but there's two. So instead of 3 billion base pairs, which is what the Genome Project delivered after $3 billion, it's 6 billion base pairs that each of us wants to know. Most medical predictions cannot be made with just one genome, you need two. So that's one aspect of personal genomics. The other aspect is it truly is about precision medicine and personalizing not just your drugs, but looking for carrier status where you can pass things on to your kids, even though you're unaffected, looking for foods, you know, possible cancer risks or actual cancer that you can find in your circulating DNA in your blood. So all of these things were greatly enabled. And I guess the third component is why they were enabled, because the price dropped. So personal genomics had this component where we weren't going to sequence 8 billion people at 3 billion times two each. We had to bring the price down. So that's just now it's $100 cost, $300 price. And that was absolutely critical for getting to the era of personal genomics. And we're still not quite there. And we won't be there until everybody who wants it knows that it exists. You know, like a lot of people just still don't know that it exists. There are probably more people that know we got onto the moon than this. And then they get it. And it's their choice. They don't have to get it. But they should understand that just like every other bit of medical news, you can tell the doctor what you want to hear and what you don't want to hear. So if you don't want to hear anything that involves surgery, you just say, look, I'm not going to get surgery. So don't bother to tell me about a disease that only has surgery as a cure. Same thing with genetics. You can say, look, if there's no gene therapy or other cure, then I don't want to hear about it.
Why doesn't like your GP just say to you, by the way, you have this as an option. Do you want to do this? And we can try to find out some more about what you're looking forward to and how we can maybe prevent this from happening.
Well, I think part of it is because your family doctor doesn't necessarily know that much more than you do about genomics. That's changing. I mean, it's just like at one point your accountant didn't know about digital computers.
Interesting. Yeah.
So it is changing. And, you know, right now we're kind of at the phase where it helps if the patient knows to ask.
Right.
And that also applies to a lot of very personal diseases. You know, if you went to a place where malaria is endemic or some more exotic tropical disease, it behooves you to tell your physician that.
Yeah.
I think we're very close to a tipping point where suddenly everybody gets clued in, where suddenly everybody wants it. And they just didn't know about it the day before. It's like 1993 with the internet. It's like nobody had really heard about it, even though it had been around since the 60s. I had used networks in 68, but nobody knew about it because it was used for weird things like FTP, you know. But then when HTTP and the web browser, suddenly businesses were on there and everybody was on there. So I think the same thing's happening pretty soon with this. It'll be like the iPhone. Everybody will be wrapping around the block virtually.
I'm a consumer. What would you tell me? Where should I go get my genome sequenced? I'm listening to this podcast and I'm like, oh my God, I want to get my genome sequenced and I want to tell my doctor everything I know. What's my first step? What do I Google? What company do I go to?
That's fairly easy because we've already talked about it. Which is Nebula, I think, has the most forward-looking, if you will, aggressive way of giving you information about all your risk factors, even if they're fairly small or uncertain. It just has a way of communicating that. And it also has a commitment to kind of very high levels of security. Most people don't want that or need that, but they're investigating it. And also they have the lowest price. So all the vectors, as far as I can say, point to that right now. I am totally biased. I'm co-founder. It's been acquired by Prophase, but I'm also a advisor to Prophase. So, and now they have much deeper pockets and very surely aimed at the consumer market because that company already had a variety of consumer products.
And one last question on this, looking forward, maybe in 5 years, maybe even sooner, where do you think genome sequencing is going to go into the clinical workflow first? Is it going to be sort of general practitioners? Is it going to be oncologists? Do you see like maybe a certain type of practice where you think it's going to start to be incorporated more regularly first?
I think it's going to be general practitioners, family doctors for carrier screening. Carrier screening applies to infectious diseases, same way you can carry genetic diseases, which is highly dependent on who you marry. So I think that kind of counseling will be especially effective premarital, preconception, you know, especially if our society is moving towards resistance to abortion, then you're going to want to have it before you've made a decision who you're going to fall in love with. So it sounds funny, but all the dating apps should include this as something that's happening behind the scenes, transparently, but not in your face, so that you can learn about it, but you don't have to. And it's basically just screening out a tiny, you know, 2 or 3 or 4% of the people. You're still going to have 96% of the people to choose from. But I think that's the most humane way to do it. It involves the least psychological stress and political stress. Yeah.
I want to switch gears and ask about one of the companies that's also come out of your lab called Dynotherapeutics. We are the AI Health podcast, so a lot of our listeners are familiar with the AI Health aspects of some of our companies that we walk through. But this one in particular has quite a few layers of technology, especially biotechnology, to work through. So I'd love for your explanation of what it is that makes this technology so promising with the use of machine learning.
I can't overstate this, and I probably will understate it unintentionally, but this is amazing. This is one of the most amazing things I've seen. And it's not just Dynotherapeutics. We actually published 7 papers using machine learning together with multiplex libraries, millions, sometimes billions of components in it. And we call that MLML for multiplex libraries with machine learning. Those 7 papers contributed directly and indirectly to 4 companies from my group, Dynotherapeutics, named after a rock climbing move, but dedicated to viral capsid engineering. So this is all about protein design, not three-dimensional structure. This is not AlphaFold, if you've heard of that. The other 3 companies are Nabla, which is designing antibodies, powerful category of proteins. In fact, one of the biggest single categories of pharmaceuticals, or fastest growing protein pharmaceuticals. And then the 3rd one is PatchBio, which is cis-regulatory elements, meaning the DNA and RNA elements that regulate the amounts of proteins. And then the 4th is Manifold Bio, which is using this machine learning to design ways of marking protein pharmaceuticals, not necessarily antibodies, but all protein pharmaceuticals, so you can test thousands of them at once in an expensive animal model, let's say a non-human primate, or possibly in humans, where you can test thousands of proteins simultaneously to see where they home in the body and, you know, what kind of pathologies they might cause or not cause. So a lot of this has to do with multiplex libraries. I think it's kind of analogous to, you know, applying deep learning, machine learning to a game of Go. There just weren't that many expert games in books for Go. I mean, there's plenty of world experience, but so they had the computer play itself and then what it learned from those games. And so when you apply AI to a lot of human health, you're data limited. I mean, you might have a lot of data. You might even have enough that you're worried about storing it, but it's still not enough. But with this, you can generate arbitrarily large amounts of data. You can do all the single mutations, every possible one of them that's actually possible to do. So you're, in a way, you're using DNA reading and writing as an IO and computing device. This, you can think of it as a peripheral, just like you might have a, you know, a special purpose bit of hardware, a GPU or a FPGA or something like that outside of your normal consumer CPU. And you can treat this way, these mega libraries, and you can treat that way. And so it's kind of playing the game of Go against itself, where you'll make a million different AAV particles, getting back to Dynotherapeutics. They'll make a million different designs, or a quarter of a million, and inject it into an animal. And then they see what tissues it goes to. And then they record all their information back into using the same kind of sequencing we were talking about earlier with the elephants. All this next gen sequencing that's revolutionized many parts of not just research, but diagnostics. Anyway, you take those barcoded viruses and ask, just count up how many were in this part of the liver and how many were in this part of the brain and so on. And then you can adjust that. You feed that all back into the machine learning. It's another million sets of game of Go, and you do it again. And so that's kind of what all 4 of the companies are doing. But Dyno just was the earliest of the 4. And it immediately, right out of the starting gate, got some pretty big deals with established large pharma and, you know, billions of dollars of commitments if they keep delivering.
Could you maybe describe what it was about machine learning or these technologies that enabled these to happen now and why they couldn't have happened a few years ago?
There's a couple of factors. One is improved computing, just better hardware. The other is just the recognition of how fairly well-ordered big data sets are a key component. In other words, for example, Google Translate, you know, they very modestly will admit that it was just, there weren't that many cases of side-by-side translations, word for word, for that many texts entered into computing systems until they made the breakthrough in translation. And that's, I think the same thing is true for molecules. These mega libraries are something that, you know, chemically synthesized libraries in the millions, were something we invented in 2002, but they didn't catch on in any labs outside of our collaborators and alumni for about a decade. So we've only had these mega libraries for about, you know, another decade. So it's very analogous to data entry or data capture, where you read all the world's books, or you scan all the streets, or you run the computer against itself in well-described games. That's the level of data that you need. And for proteins, you now have on the order of 50,000 examples of every protein, meaning that there's a kind of the tree of life extends, and as it ramifies, you get lots of variations on the protein that have already been vetted for working. These are not just random versions. These are random versions that work really well. And they're like the winners in a whole series of lotteries that, you know, for billions of years led up to there. So you have these 50,000 winners. And of course, everything else is kind of a control for every protein. And so you can use that for predicting the 3D structure. But we chose to just use them for guiding functional substitutions without going to the 3D structure. And to illustrate that is if you have like the 3D structure of a serine protease. It's called a serine protease because there's a key amino acid that's a serine. If you take the oxygen off of that serine, it's now an alanine and it's no longer a protease, but its three-dimensional structure is exactly the same. The root mean square deviation and the atomic positions as a fraction of a, you know, atomic bond. There's just no change, but it's completely dead. So that's why the 3D structure is not the sine qua non. It's not the holy grail. The holy grail is functional substitutions that allow you to change. And the Dyno Therapeutics, so the co-authors, myself and Pierce Ogden and Eric Kelsick and others, wrote a paper where we showed that we could mutate 28 amino acids, so a piece of a protein, so thoroughly that we can substitute every single amino acid. And to put that in perspective, if you use a naive model, not these logistic regressions, but you know, a naive model, it's hard to get above 4 changes. So you can go from 4 out of 28 to 28 out of 28 using machine learning.
So you mentioned that these companies are selling into big pharma companies and have deals in place. Can you maybe just describe a little bit what the end product looks like, how this gene therapy is working down the line?
So Dyno Therapeutics is selling delivery. It's not necessarily specifying the payload, although they may someday, but right now they're selling delivery. And that's a big problem. Everybody goes gaga over specific payloads, but if you don't get it to the right place, it's like a supply chain thing. It's great that my television's in some harbor somewhere. That's Dyno. Nabla is making antibodies, which, as I said, is one of the major categories of rapid uptake by the industry. The antibodies can combine to your favorite target and neutralize it or what have you. And so all of these, the markets are already established for better gene therapy delivery. I mean, there are FDA approved gene therapies, and all of those could have better immune profile, so they don't stimulate the immune system. They could have better delivery to the target tissue and not to the off-target tissues, and that's what Dyno is doing. And then there's antibodies, and then there's all the other protein therapeutics, which is what Manifold Bio is doing. And again, all those protein therapeutics date back to the dawn of biotech, basically, or the recombinant DNA revolution. I was one of the first employees at Biogen, and I had a lot of friends in Genentech and Amgen, and those were all protein pharmaceuticals. So basically, all these things are well established. It's just they didn't have machine learning until the last couple of years.
Dr. Church, this has been absolutely fantastic. I'd like to end with one question here, which is asking you about the future you'd like to see and you will build over the next 5 to 10 years, what your hopes for that look like.
So 5 to 10 years is a very short period of time with respect to normal clinical trials and getting off the planet, which are some of the things that I think are important for survival of the species. But, you know, I would hope that in 5 or 10 years, we will have multiple aging reversal drugs, which will treat all the diseases, basically. They'll be in clinical trials, but we won't necessarily everybody using them yet by then. But we'll have a clear idea of where it's going. Then hopefully with the luxury of these exponential technologies that are improving faster than Moore's Law, we might finally be able to treat the diseases that impact less wealthy nations. I think it's extremely important that we float all the boats, not just the rich ones, and because it's all one ecosystem. It's all one. We all share germs, clearly. We hopefully will not get a bigger wake-up call than COVID-19. Hopefully that's enough so that we don't do the same thing with monkeypox that we did with COVID-19, for example, or all the other things that are out there coming from our farms and from the wilderness that we're invading and disturbing. So I hope that we get better touch with the ecosystem such as it affects our health. You know, even if you're not a tree hugger, you should be a kid hugger, and you don't want your kids to die of something that's a function of zoonotic diseases and climate change.
Dr. Church, this has been so extraordinary. Thank you for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope it has some impact.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Professor George Church for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And for the last time this season, and until next season, stay safe and stay healthy.
This episode of the AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee, Navami Jain, and Ashwath Radhachandran. Music by Ethan A. Chi. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.